You make the argument in your book that peace building itself and the way it is done by this peaceland peace building community can also make things worse. How do you mean that?
Well, unfortunately, sometimes peace building efforts will actually fuel violence. So one of the examples that that I often take is the example of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We know that peace builders usually focus on three main topics: the mineral exploitation of natural resources as the main cause of violence, they focus on sexual violence as the main consequence of violence, and they focus on state building, reconstructing the state as the main solution to the conflict. Well, the problem is that, take sexual violence. Now, if you talk to a woman who has been raped in Congo or, you know, in any country in the world, the woman will tell you, well, I would much prefer not to have been raped than to be given, you know, a sewing machine or to be given some kind of compensation afterwards. Now, the leaders of the armed groups, they're not stupid. When they want people to pay attention to them, they know, well, if they do lootings, it's not going to bring attention to their group. Now, if they rape a lot of people, that's going to bring attention to their group. So the focus, the international focus on sexual violence has created a very perverse incentive system. And it has made sexual violence into a very effective tool for combatants who want to achieve their goals.
You talk to hundreds of peace builders on all kinds of levels. A lot of them mainly stay within their group of expatriates and that they don't really get too much contact with the local population. Why do you think this everyday interaction is so much of a problem?
It's a huge problem because it means that because you don't have enough contacts between interveners and local populations, interveners are perceived as these kind of aliens who come here and they impose ideas, they don't understand what's going on, they impose very detrimental and stupid policies. And so that creates a lot of resentment among local populations.
Even if you don't speak the language, you could have a translator and find out about more facts or talk to local people. Why is that still so much of a distance or separation between these groups?
There are different reasons. The first one is that interveners share a common experience of life in conflict zones. They feel that there are foreigners who don't speak the language, don't have family lives, they live in very difficult conditions, their job is emotionally draining, and very often they feel that only other foreign peace builders can really understand what they are going through. And on top of that, you have all of the routines, the everyday routines that peace-building organizations put in place that prevent good contacts between interveners, foreign interveners, and local people. For example, you have the security routines, the fact that interveners have to drive with doors locked, windows closed. They're not supposed to go to specific places at night because it's too dangerous. They have curfews.
So they kind of helicopter in their white, big SUVs, and they are already looking very removed from the real life in the streets.
Exactly.
And they also have to be because there are security concerns.
There are security constraints. But the point is that you can ensure your security in a much better way when you use what experts call the acceptance approach to security, meaning being accepted by all of the armed groups and all of the local communities with whom you work.
Which, of course, you can only become if you get in close contact with them.
Exactly, and if you understand what's going on and if you understand the local context. So it's a vicious circle. And interveners have to remain neutral or impartial because otherwise they're going to get in trouble.
And also they could influence the conflict, which they don't want to do.
Exactly. But then that means that they try not to have too many contacts with local people because otherwise they might be accused of bias.
So it seems like
on and on.
The system itself is kind of set up to also be frustrating, both for the
yes.
locals but also for the peace builders. But you also say in your book there's a couple of people all over the world whom you met who seem to be more successful at their job in peaceland.
Yes, exactly. There are people who actually challenge all of the usual ways of working that we've been talking about. And so they go only to countries that they actually know very well about. They ensure their security by interacting with local people rather than by isolating themselves from their environments.
You also make recommendations in your book to policymakers and peaceland workers. What are some of these recommendations? How could this be improved?
Instead of automatically going to the very expensive bar where all the other expatriates meet, then try to make a point of asking one of your local colleagues and then go to a local place. Also, when you think about putting in place security systems for your mission, if you want to have sandbags to protect your walls so that if there are fightings, then the bullets won't go through the walls. You can put the sandbags inside the walls so that it doesn't show from the outside.
So it doesn't look like a fortress.
Exactly. So that it doesn't look like a fortress, so that when local people walk by your house, they don't look at it and say, wow, what's going on? Like, why is he so afraid of us?
Do you think in general, foreigners and their intervention is needed for peace building?
I think that foreigners can have a very important contribution to make to building peace in conflict zones. When you're a foreigner, you can make sensitive decisions much more easily. You are less sensitive to pressure to give certain kind of jobs or certain kind of perks. Sometimes also there is so much mistrust on the ground between local people, between different groups that have been fighting, that it's easier for them to start a dialogue when you have someone from outside who comes in. And also interveners bring some kind of knowledge. So foreigners can give ideas, they can give resources, they can provide a safe space. They have specific contributions they can make. So that's why I think foreigners are really important in conflict zones, but we need to change the way they work and they live on an everyday basis if we want these contributions to be as good and as effective as they could.
You yourself have worked as an intervener in various conflict zones, including Kosovo and others, and the DRC, Congo. If you were to go back now as an intervener, which mistake would you definitely not make?
I think I would make all of the mistakes again. But then I think that I would be more careful about, I mean, learning as much as possible before I go to a country. I would be very careful about not being arrogant. So I would try to be as humble as possible when I interact with local people. I would try to understand the conflict from their perspective first. And I would try to construct my social network with local people. And I would be very careful about my everyday life. So, for example, when people get very stressed out and frustrated, as happened all the time in peace building, because the work is so hard and the job is so hard, I would control my temper probably much better. I've seen so many people yell at their colleagues. So I think I would do much more self-care to make sure that I'm not too stressed out and that whenever there is a problem, I can handle it in the most respectful manner possible.
And of course, yelling at your colleagues might not convince them that you really want to make peace. And that was Séverine Ottesser, who explained why everyday attitudes are really important in international peacekeeping and how this difficult and sometimes frustrating job can be done more effectively. If you want to check out this very interesting book that we were talking about, it's called Peaceland, and you can find some excerpts online if you just Google Peaceland. For our last report today, we are going to Ecuador in Central America. Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, has one of the highest popularity ratings in Latin America. During his 9 years in office, he has invested heavily in education, public health, and other social programs in what he labeled a citizens' revolution. But despite the improvements for many, there's also another side to Correa's policies: political persecution. Reporter Roxandra Guidi reports from Quito about a pattern of persecution of critical thinkers by the government, state media, and the courts.
Lourdes Tibán is sitting in her office at the National Assembly in Quito. Tibán is a member of Ecuador's assembly, the country's parliament. She's one of the most prominent indigenous leaders in the country and wears a traditional black fedora hat and ample skirt or pollera. Her critical stance on the regime and her fight for social, indigenous, and environmental rights, as well as freedom of expression, is a thorn in the flesh of those who would rather silence her.
I've been getting threats for a long time, phone calls, even public insults by the president. I thought about filing a complaint, but if the justice is in the government's hands, why am I going to complain?
In 2011, Diban was attacked and assaulted outside her office.
I filed a complaint with the district attorney's office in July of 2011, and nothing happened for 4 years. Then they came to the assembly building again, grabbed me and beat me up. They called me names.
That was in September 2015. The complaint she filed had no effect. But she got a message from her attacker via Twitter.
Look what this man says. So what do you want now? I hit you. So what's the problem? So the very next day, those people owned up to beating me and the government did nothing?
Diban and her party used to support the current president and his citizens' revolution. Many of the new laws passed in the last 9 years under the leftist president were aimed at improving the situation of poor Ecuadorians, enhancing social inclusion of indigenous peoples and other marginalized groups, and improving health services. But not all measures that were passed are held by everyone. And Diban and others feel they have become targets of attacks for being too critical. For this report, despite multiple interview requests, neither Ecuador's District Attorney's Office nor the Ministry of Justice or the Human Rights Defender's Office responded. In a 2012 TV interview with a Spanish broadcaster, Ecuador's President Rafael Correa denied that critical individuals were being targeted by his government and blamed the persecution of critics on the media instead.
Como nunca, por fin se ejercen los derechos humanos.
We respect human rights in Ecuador now like we never had before. The rights to health, to education, to work. We don't go after critics, like they say. We go after liars and criminals, not people, as the media says.
Correa has had an antagonistic relationship with the media since the beginning of his presidency in 2006. That's when he advocated for a law that would limit media freedoms. In 2013, the infamous Communications Law created a new media monitoring agency tasked with, quote-unquote, democratizing media. So far, one of the main tasks of the media agency has been to fine media organizations for criticizing the government or the president, critics say.
What's new about Correa's administration is the amount of resources that the state now has at its disposal to build a media monitoring agency, for example.
That's Pablo Ospina, a political science professor at Quito's Universidad Andina Simón Bolívar.
So now we see the systematic persecution of critics on social media and the monitoring of political players that may pose a threat to the government.
With data from the district attorney's office, Ospina found that between 2008 and 2013, there had been an average of 350 cases a year of Ecuadorians who were accused of terrorism, sabotage, or rebellion. Many of those being charged with terrorism were leading protests against Correa's policies. And the attacks on critics continue. Last summer, new protests erupted across Ecuador. Due to declining oil revenues, the government has been struggling with an increasing economic crisis. And it had just proposed a bill to tax inheritances by up to 77%. Lourdes Diban led many of the protests, as did other indigenous leaders, along with labor activists and student leaders. There were widespread arrests and reports of excessive police force. Many also opposed a set of controversial changes to the Constitution that were put in place in December 2015. The 16 new bills included the lifting of limited terms for political offices, permitting indefinite re-election of public officials, and granted the military an even bigger role in society. Another bill criminalized street protests.
Since January of last year, the political situation here has deteriorated a lot, and the government has responded like so many others have historically in Latin America, by becoming more autocratic.
That is Juan, a free speech activist who does not want his real name mentioned in the media for fear of retribution. Over the past 2 years, he's leaked government documents online. For instance, some that reveal that Correa's party demands monetary donations from its members. Juan has also revealed documents about a secret intelligence agency called SENAIN. Apparently, the government has been spying on activists like Juan.
Yo siempre supe cuando iba a publicar cosas del gobierno que...
When I started leaking government documents, I knew I could get into trouble. This is my country, so I'm risking my family, my home. But I couldn't sit by knowing there is no respect for legality here, that anyone opposing the government has no way to defend themselves.
Since the last wave of protests in December, national polling firm Cedatos found that President Correa's popularity, which used to be very high, has fallen to 45%. The next national elections are coming up in the summer of 2017. Meanwhile, National Assembly member Lourdes Tibán has announced that she will be running for president. For DW, I'm Ruxandra Guidi in Quito, Ecuador.
And that's all from World in Progress this week. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in again next week. To download the podcast, go to iTunes or find us at dw.com/worldinprogress. From our studio team here in Bonn, Germany, I'm Anke Rasper saying goodbye.